This is Radio Boston. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. Right and wrong, black and white, when it comes to ethics, especially in the workplace, the consequences aren't always clear, especially if you're the head of a major Boston hospital and you've been admonished for, quote, lapses in judgment involving a female friend and employee. Later this hour, we'll hear the embattled CEO of Beth Israel Deaconess Medical Center, Paul Levy, as he tries to navigate shades of gray. And then there's Crimson.
I always thought it would be better to be a fake somebody than a real nobody.
I don't believe a single word you've said.
Across the river in Cambridge, Harvard is still reeling from a case of plagiarism and forgery that's so intricate that one Harvard professor says it reminded him of the movie The Talented Mr. Ripley. That was a clip that you just heard from that movie. Matt Damon's character assumed a completely new identity in that film. And while former Harvard student Adam Wheeler didn't go quite that far, he did fake his admissions package, forged letters of recommendation, and plagiarized award-winning papers at Harvard for more than 2 years. Wheeler presents an extreme case, of course, but what about other smaller acts of plagiarism on college campuses? Is it a problem? And students, come on, I mean, have you been swamped during finals and felt a little tempted to do some cut and paste? What can colleges do to catch and control acts of plagiarism? Join us at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. You can also find us on Facebook and Twitter at Radio Boston. Well, joining us now in the studio is Dr. Eli Neuberger. He's assistant professor of pediatrics at the Harvard Medical School and author of The Men They Will Become, The Nature and Nurture of the Male Character. Welcome to Radio Boston, Dr. Neuberger.
Thanks, Megan.
Also with us from the studios of WSND in South Bend, Indiana, is Susan Bloom. She's professor of anthropology at Notre Dame, and she's also the author of My Word, Plagiarism and College Culture. Professor Bloom, welcome to Radio Boston.
Thank you. It's a pleasure to be here.
Dr. Neuberger, if I just might start with you, I mean, the Adam Wheeler case that we read about this morning, it's pretty extreme. He's a 23-year-old senior. He was dismissed from Harvard in October when it was discovered that he had basically plagiarized his way into the university by forging letters of recommendation, even forging transcripts, getting letterhead that looked like he had been a student at MIT. He, while at Harvard, he forged almost entire theses from other students, right, and even work done by professors at Harvard. So it's an extreme case. But from those details that we know about him, what can we determine about this young man's character?
Well, in character terms, we read character, we judge character by the decisions that we make in the face of moral conflict, where we need to reconcile our desires, our impulses, against the needs and rights of others and the standards of society. At its core, his behavior surely represents a paucity of admirable character in the many choices that he made to deceive in the interest of getting ahead. But I think one needs to be cautious to attach to it such a psychiatric characterization as sociopathy, or for that matter, in calling it an extreme case.
You don't see it as an extreme case.
To discount the possibility that had he not applied to Harvard for a recommendation for a Rhodes Scholarship, mm-hmm, he might never have been caught. And it gives pause to wonder how prevalent is this phenomenon in an age where there's dishonesty all around us, and very frequently children have inappropriate models for behavior in the face of a competitive environment and getting ahead in the world, which includes perhaps getting a prestigious university degree, and as well the easy availability of technologies like Photoshop, like the internet, to seize other people's writings. So this, it seems to me, is an exaggeration, but needs to be understood against a moral ground of a great deal of dishonesty in our society today.
So there's the backdrop of the place that we all, the culture that we're all growing up in.
Yes, let me just add one thing. I've been on the faculty of Harvard Medical School for a number of years. Okay. There have been, in my hospital, in my academic department, and elsewhere in the school, no few examples where people have embellished their credentials, where they've falsified research data where they've submitted manuscripts with co-authors who never even knew that they were on the paper.
These are things you've seen in your professional life here.
Absolutely. Huh. And these are extremely high-functioning individuals in arguably one of the best academic medical environments in the world. What does that tell us about the extent to which in our competitive world, people will do things that are inappropriate, immoral, arguably, and violative of the trust that other people have in them? My suggestion is that they're more prevalent than we really want to believe.
I would love to. We're going to get into that more in just a moment. But Professor Susan Bloom, if I can turn to you briefly, a few more details here about Adam Wheeler's case that we've found out today. One is that while he claimed to be an MIT student when he tried wrote his transfer application to Harvard, he was actually a student at Bowdoin College, and he was dismissed there for violations of their academic code. Then once he gets discovered at Harvard, as Dr. Neuberger points out, for having basically plagiarized a Rhodes Scholarship application and a Fulbright application, he then goes on to try and create or fabricate another admissions package for Yale and Brown. So there's a pattern here, and as Dr. Neuberger says, it's a pattern against a bigger backdrop of costs and consequences that maybe aren't clear when it comes to plagiarism. So in your studies of plagiarism in college culture, do you see students kind of not really seeing that it's that big of a deal if there aren't clear costs and consequences?
Well, they see the consequences in terms of the rewards. There are rewards for cutting corners, which is you can get more done, you can succeed, you can get credentials, you can get high grades. All kinds of things come to you by doing it sort of the quick way. And many students, I won't say most, but many students have learned that long before they ever come to college. So I've heard of students, for instance, signing up for organizations so that they can add something to their resume when they apply to college. And that's not exactly cheating, but it's not exactly honest either. If they say they're in the French club and they never go to a meeting, are they truly in the French club? Maybe technically they've signed the roster, but they're not participating. Mm-hmm. There are a lot of messages like that that students are getting early on, and in some ways the most competitive students are getting that message even more than other people. If students want to go to a local college, they don't have to work so hard. So it's the ones who are engaged in this high-stakes competition, as Dr. Neuberger said, who are really so concerned about that incredible resume, that incredible GPA. There's a book called The Overachievers by Alexandra Robbins that I'd like to recommend to everybody, where she talks about what high school students will resort to in order to have this kind of hyper-competitive edge over everybody else, and often with the complicity of their parents, teachers, administrators, and consultants.
And Professor Bloom, I believe also in your book you write that it's not just the incredible pressure, but the college application process in and of itself kind of adds to this, because students believe that they have to achieve some sort of they know basically the box that they feel like they need to fit into to get into these elite institutions. So they create a persona for themselves almost that may or may not be authentic to who they are.
Exactly. I contrast an authentic self, which is somebody whose actions come from within, with a performance self, who is concerned primarily with presenting the self in order to have certain kinds of rewards and practical consequences. So in that sense, they're willing to go through any hoops or to go through the motions to pretend to write a paper that the teacher wants, even if they couldn't care less about it. So one of the things that concerns me the most is that this isn't really what education is for, but it's certainly one of the lessons they've been learning quite well. Mm.
Dr. Neuberger, if I can turn to you briefly, given these pressures. We don't want to excuse plagiarism here at all, but given this context, does it surprise you, or maybe it doesn't surprise you, that this is a behavior then that would continue for some students when they do actually get admitted to the college of their choice?
Well, strikingly, in this situation, it doesn't appear as if anything was enough for this young man. And even after Harvard threw him out, he still tried to do the same number with Yale and with Brown. This does suggest some kind of a compulsion on his part, or a delight in trying to outwit the people who define the rules. I just found something, though, that I thought would be so interesting in light of the anthropologist's perspective that we've just heard so beautifully. The great psychoanalyst Erik Erikson, in his book Identity, Youth, and Crisis, characterized the big task of infancy, which is the formation and sustaining of trust in one's world. And this kind of cheating is nothing if not a violation of trust that makes one, all of us, wonder, you know, to what extent we can trust others. But Erikson put it so well when he talked about the baby's task. He says, "One cannot know what happens in a baby, but direct observation, as well as overwhelming clinical evidence, indicates that early mistrust is accompanied by an experience of total rage, with fantasies of the total domination or even destruction of the sources of pleasure and provision, and that such fantasies and rages live on in the individual and are revived in extreme states and situations." I think here, obviously, you can't predict from infancy, which ends by definition at the age of 12 months. But it's vital, it seems to me, to reflect for all of us on the sources of trust and how best to nurture it for those of us who are parents. Mm.
Dr. Ilan Neuberger, stand by. Professor Susan Bloom down at Notre Dame, hang in there with us. We're going to be joined by you, our listeners, and another guest when we come back after the break in just a moment. Because also later in this hour, Beth Israel Deaconess CEO Paul Levy says sorry for hiring a woman he was having a relationship with.
"I like to think I learned from my mistakes. I'm certainly not going to make this one again."
We'll hear from him later in the hour. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. This is Radio Boston. We will be right back. Radio Boston, I'm Meghna Chakrabarty.
"Is Funky okay? Is he in trouble?"
"Ma'am, I'm sorry to have to tell you, your son is forging checks."
"Forging checks? Wait, I'm sure we can take care of that. I'm working part-time at the church now. Just tell me how much yours and I'll pay you back."
"So far, it's about $1.3 million.
$1.3 million. That's Tom Hanks laying the cold, hard truth down in the 2002 film Catch Me If You Can. In that movie, Hanks played an FBI agent on the trail of young master check forger Frank Abagnale, played by Leonardo DiCaprio. Well, someone who did get caught forging, not checks, but letters and transcripts, is former Harvard student Adam Wheeler. We're talking about his eye-popping case of plagiarism this hour and the scourge of smaller cases plaguing college campuses. So what do you think? Join us at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. I'm joined by Professor Susan Bloom. She's author of My Word, Plagiarism and College Culture. She's with us from Notre Dame in South Bend, Indiana. Also, Dr. Eli Neuberger. He's assistant professor of pediatrics at Harvard Medical School. Avi's on the line from the South End. Avi, welcome to Radio Boston.
Hi, Meghna. Thank you.
What's your thought today?
Well, I had an interesting situation occur when I was attending school in Boston. I was graduating a semester early, and I think that gave my best friend the idea to try to graduate a semester early as well. And I think the pressure of that, combined with all the other academics and things that graduating seniors face, are plagiarism. And she actually plagiarized a paper and was caught. And instead of graduating a semester early, she was delayed by a year and a half because she was on suspension academically.
But she wasn't expelled from the school. She just was suspended.
She was just suspended, and she received it incomplete for the class. But it shows there are varying degrees of plagiarism, and I think in this case it shows there's definitely a level of competitive nature that might drive people to that degree, taking on too many responsibilities. And also, I think it speaks to these people are desperate in a lot of cases because I think desperate times call for desperate measures, and I would definitely say plagiarizing would be categorized as a desperate measure because you're definitely at risk. And the school I went to, Boston University, a lot of the courses have plagiarism databases where you actually have to submit your paper online.
Yeah, Avi, your phone's breaking up a little bit on us, but we're definitely going to get to the point that you made here in just a second. Let's sneak in another call. Bob's calling from Salisbury. Welcome to Radio Boston, Bob.
Hi, Meghna. Yeah, I just got out of a fluid mechanics final at UMass Lowell about 30 minutes ago, and I figured I'd share a little bit of a story with you. I've noticed a trend this week in taking up a couple of my finals and an increase in bathroom breaks across the board among my peers.
You don't think it's just all those bottles of water people are bringing in when they take their finals?
Absolutely not, Meghna, and I'll tell you why. I go to my classes, and I notice when people leave the room to go to the bathroom, and it's like on average maybe like one or two of my peers per class. And I've taken like three finals over the past 5 days, and I've seen double digits for all those finals. And you know, it's one after the other. The proctor's only allowed to let one person go to the bathroom at a time. That's supposed to be the safeguard against cheating.
Mm-hmm.
But it sounds like
you don't think that's enough. Bob, thank you so much for your call. Have a happy summer, by the way, and congratulations on finishing all those finals. Well, to see if there's actually a trend going on here, as maybe we heard reported from two of our listeners, we're joined now by Professor Don McCabe. He's a professor of management and global business at Rutgers Business School, and he's conducted extensive research on cheating and plagiarism in higher education. Don McCabe, welcome to Radio Boston.
Thank you very much.
So, simple question. I mean, we're talking about a major case at Harvard, but we've heard from students here just moments ago that plagiarism and cheating's pretty prevalent. Do you see that it's going up on college campuses in the United States?
I think it's going up. The interesting thing is that the data that I collect from students suggests that it's actually going down a little bit. But I think, you know, reading the comments that students offer and digging a little deeper, I think the situation is the students are becoming much more dismissive of cheating. They're engaging in activities that, you know, 40 years ago when I was in college, I might have considered cheating, that today they would simply not, even though, you know, probably the average older person would, you know, such as internet plagiarism, for example, where you're taking bits and pieces from different sources and weaving it together into something you consider your own without providing the appropriate citations.
So the whole attitude about what it means to cheat or plagiarize, you think, is changing among students?
Absolutely, especially on what they would consider the more trivial or moderate issues. You know, on real serious issues, such as we're talking about with Mr. Wheeler, I think most students would agree that that was cheating. But anything less than that, I think there's an uncertainty out there as to what it actually is.
Now, is there, Professor McCabe, in your studies and the surveys that you've done of students, I mean, are we talking 10% of students say this, 20%, 90%? Is there, you know, a number that you can put out there?
Sure. If I look, I can go all the way back to 1964. There was a gentleman who was at Northeastern University at the time who did the first major multi-campus study of cheating. And he looked at 10 behaviors that range from doing your homework with others when you're supposed to do it alone all the way to copying off of somebody's exam or plagiarism. And he found that 83% of the students admitted they had engaged in at least one of these 10 behaviors over the course of their work. In the 2002 to 2009 period, which is my work at the moment, I have that number at 66%. So it's, you know, a 20% reduction, something like that. It's enough to be significant, but yet, as I suggested already, I really don't believe that that's what's happening.
Does that mean, at the same time, how then would you suggest that if you have more than half, two-thirds of students freely admitting, yes, I am cheating or plagiarizing my way through college, do you have any suggestions then how to deal with this majority of students?
Well, I've got several, and they're, at least one of them, my favorite one, is somewhat controversial, and even I'm beginning to believe it's a little controversial myself. I know one of your other guests, Susan, and she and I have been around the horn on this once before, but I'm a great believer in academic honor codes, where we put more trust and responsibility in students after we've appropriately oriented them to the concept and tell them what it's all about. And I've found that schools that have honor codes actually have lower degrees of cheating, despite the fact that in many cases they don't proctor their exams. They have students attesting to their honesty. They have students reporting other students, although that happens very infrequently.
Professor McCabe, let me just jump
in. For example, you know, take Turnitin.com, the most current plagiarism detection software that's out there. schools that are using that, students are saying, you know, we've had to learn how to do other things to get around Turnitin.com.
Mm-hmm.
It almost becomes a game for some students if you really increase your vigilance. So I'm all for honor codes and teaching students respect and responsibility and integrity, because those are values that they'll carry away when they graduate.
Professor McCabe, let me just ask you one quick question here. If you just said that you believe that the whole attitude around what constitutes cheating, what constitutes plagiarism, is changing, how is it that an honor code could work if students are doing things that they don't even think are wrong to begin with?
Well, that's why I said you have to go through a very strong orientation to decide what's a violation of the community standards. Honor codes don't work because students want to be honest, because some faculty member said so, but because they want to be honest vis-a-vis the other students.
Could I just ask...
Yeah, Dr. Neuberger, please.
Professor McCabe, I've admired your work for years, and I wanted to ask a question with regards to the definition of cheating and the utility of honor codes. We can see this as a violation of trust in a certain sense, and I think this generalizes to this former Harvard student. It's a form of theft. But it seems to me that in order to put into place an honor code, one really has to talk about trust and the values of the community, and that an action like this is really violative of our knowing who one another are. Take, for example, Avi's question earlier.
The
I think you were on the air when,
mm-hmm.
or you were probably listening when that call came in. When I heard that about the year and a half suspension of his friend who was trying to graduate early and thus plagiarized a paper for efficiency's sake, that struck me as being a rather harsh sentence for something that we know happens frequently. Wouldn't it have been a teachable moment to bring in others to reflect on what it is we're all about?
I can get you people that will argue that either way. Certainly there's some people, and Gary Pavella, who's now at Syracuse University, who's an authority in his field, certainly believes in teachable moments, that catching a student cheating for the first time, in his opinion, is clearly a teachable moment. But when you have a repetitive offender, you've got to eventually say, hey, this is somebody we're not reaching and we need to do something more significant.
Professor Susan Bloom, I heard you. Professor Bloom, I heard you try. Sorry, Professor McCabe, I just want to. I heard Professor Bloom try to get in there. I want to give her a chance here. That's all right. Go ahead.
Oh, that's okay. I wanted to just raise the issue of what education is all about. And one of the things that I'm all in favor of honor codes in the sense that it makes people really reflect on their values and reflect on responsibilities. And I certainly agree with Mr. McCabe about the importance of teaching that as something that students will take forward with them after they graduate. But if students are in school entirely for the credential or for the credits or for the grade and never for what they're learning, then it's easy for them to kind of skim their way through their work for their entire time in school. And so somehow we have to get our attention back to what the purpose is of this entire huge, expensive, time-consuming enterprise.
Professor Bloom, we have a caller on the line who wants to speak to exactly this point. Sylvia is calling from Middleborough. Sylvia, welcome to Radio Boston.
Thank you very much.
Go ahead, Sylvia.
It's interesting because we're having this conversation, and I see a direct correlation to all of this feeding in. It's almost like the reverse of the financial aspect of the bubble. We fed this idea that we have to have X, Y, and Z, or else we're not good Americans. We haven't accomplished anything, and our lives are therefore void of any kind of importance. We've kind of transposed what satisfies us and what values us as Americans and as people as a whole. And I think we're starting to see that cross the lines in our education. It used to be you went to school to not just get a good degree, but to better yourself as a person, to become more global, to understand your environment and those around you. Now it's like the professor just said, it's all about getting those credentials, because after all, those credentials are going to get you that big white house on the hill or that big car, that big SUV that the Air Force defines you as a person. And I think we're starting to see that. And I think college students kind of justify it as, why should I have ethics and values and morals in what I'm doing when the work industry that I'm going into clearly has none?
Mm-hmm.
So they're kind of following the trend. We've kind of set the example from the top up, and this is what we're getting. Does it justify the student in what he did? Absolutely not. I do think that there are some definitely some deep-seated other issues there, but we can kind of see where it all kind of transposed from. And unfortunately, he's not the first, and he won't be the last.
Sylvia,
I think we're going to see I'm sorry.
I was just going to say that we got your point, and actually, I mean, it's one that I think a lot of people would agree with and want to reflect on, but I want to sneak another call in here. Thank you so much for your call, Sylvia. Jen's calling from Amesbury. Welcome to Radio Boston, Jen.
Hi, Meghna. Thanks for taking my call. I'm a high school English teacher, and so this topic is very relevant to my daily life. We see plagiarism every day and cheating on various levels all over the place. And it's really difficult to address it effectively. And when we do catch somebody where we have what we think is a rock-solid case, and we've got it highlighted with the source that they used, and we bring it to the administration, often the administration will kind of cave into parental pressure and, not really provide the kind of consequences that might stop the student from doing this again. And, in addition, you look at the numbers that we're dealing with in a public school, and those numbers are getting bigger. I mean, in my town, they just approved class sizes going up to 30 next year. Hmm. And, think about that in terms of the number of students we're looking at. How are we going to teach them effectively personal responsibility for their ideas when we're barely going to have enough time to read all of their ideas and respond to those ideas in an honest way?
Jen, thank you so much for your call. I've just got a couple minutes left here. Dr. Eli Neuberger, last thought from you. Obviously, there's an issue of the culture that we're raising children and students in. So how to begin to chip away at a culture which, according to many of our callers, seems to be encouraging this changing definition of what it means to plagiarize and to cheat and to succeed?
Well, at the risk of sounding fatuous, I think this is a task for all of us, for teachers, for parents, for kids, to reckon with what it is that we're about in the world, and especially in competitive academic environments, to reflect back again on my experience at Harvard Medical School, where I regret to say cheating occurs, giving doubt about the veracity and trustworthiness of a lot of physician behavior. My own view of this is that it has to be understood as a systemic challenge, not as a defect in an individual that it needs to be seized on and where people need to be held out as examples. And similarly, too, although I have no sympathy for this young former Harvard student who clearly is on a career of getting ahead by cheating and needs to be punished appropriately in order to deter other actions by other people of this kind, we've got to reckon with this as a serious social problem that generalizes to our financial institutions, that generalizes to our political world, and unfortunately in those institutions like schools on which we depend to define what we like to think of as a meritocracy.
Professor Don McCabe, your last thought.
I'm going to echo one thing that I think Dr. Neuberger just said, if I understood it correctly. And that is, I don't think we can impose any system on students. They're going to reject it if we try to impose it. I think we need to bring students into the equation. I agree we need to bring parents and teachers as well. So it needs to be a community effort, and I would support that very strongly.
And Professor Susan Bloom at Notre Dame, I mean, Dr. Eli Neuberger mentioned the meritocracy, which is, I think, one of the reasons why people feel so outraged when they find that cheating is so prevalent. So from your view, having looked into this, and as a college professor, is there any way to reinstill in students who have made it this far that, going on your own merits is a worthwhile thing to do?
Well, actually, I really wanted to quote both Dr. Neuberger and Dr. McCabe and to use their words because they had said it so well. I think that this is, in fact, a systemic issue, and if we can teach students that it's not only the end goal but the process that they're supposed to be learning from, then I think we have a chance of getting them to focus some attention on the actual work itself, to put in the time that it takes to write a paper, to think about the material, to process it. But without that, I think we are in some ways setting up a system that gives us the results that we see in front of us.
Mm. Well, that's Professor Susan Bloom. She's a professor of anthropology at Notre Dame and author of My Word, Plagiarism and College Culture. Professor Bloom, thank you so much for being with us.
Oh, it's been a great pleasure. Thank you so much.
Also, my thanks to Professor Don McCabe. He is at the Management and Global Business School at Rutgers University. Professor McCabe, thank you.
Thank you.
And Dr. Eli Neuberger, assistant professor of pediatrics at Harvard Medical School and author of The Men They Will Become, The Nature and Nurture of the Male Character. True pleasure to have you with us today.
And for me too, Mika. Thank you.
Well, in this age of the web, it would seem difficult to plagiarize and get very far. I mean, can't an admissions officer look at a packet and say, just Google it to see if they've seen it before? WBUR's Andrew Phelps is here to tell us what one company, we've heard a little bit about them, is doing online. Hey, Andrew.
Hi, Meghna. Of course, there's more to the web than what Google knows about, and that's where Turnitin.com comes in. We've heard it alluded to in this conversation. There's a new flavor of this service that just launched for university admissions, apparently a highly requested feature.
So how exactly does that work?
Okay, the Turnitin people have a huge database of existing work. I mean, Meghna, imagine the entire internet, petabytes of data.
I don't even know how many zeros that is.
Millions and millions of gigabytes. Turnitin has a copy of all of that, plus newspaper archives, paid academic journals, plus all of the documents ever submitted to the service previously, something like 120 million homework assignments and term papers.
So they have this vast database, but an admissions officer at a university receives, say, a cover letter from a potential student and uploads it to the service?
Uploads it to the service, and then the algorithm flags any derivative patterns and alerts the university. What fascinates me is how the company keeps up with new forms of plagiarism. I talked to Jeff Lorton in California. He runs the admissions side of Turnitin.com.
There are literally thousands and thousands of companies and websites that you can commission just about anything you want, including everything through even your PhD thesis, if you could convince your review board that you wrote it.
I would have a hard time defending a thesis I didn't write. Anyway, according to the company, the number one site for fake admissions essays, at least in one sample they collected, was personalstatement.info, which provides, quote, ideas and inspiration. Lorton tells me the inspiration goes as far as copy and paste.
Ah, so how many people do we know to be plagiarizing using these online services?
We don't know for sure, but Turnitin did a beta test a few years ago with a batch of about 450,000 college applications back in 06, 07. The software found matches in about 200,000 of those submissions. Mind you, a match doesn't automatically mean plagiarism. Of those matches, a little more than a third were, quote, significant, very likely to be plagiarism. But at that point, it's up to the university to decide how to interpret the results and whether to deem something plagiarism.
Okay, so one last question for you, Andrew. Is there a potential for false positives? I mean, say a kid, like, places a quote mark and the service thinks that it's actually plagiarism, so someone getting busted for doing nothing wrong, really.
Right, or if two kids on the opposite sides of the country write the same thing and they don't even know they're plagiarizing. I asked Jeff Lorton about that. He says, first of all, the system pulls out all the common words, the ofs and the thes and such. I'll let Lorton take it from here.
The chances of the same two people writing the exact same 16 words or pattern, it's less than 1 in 1 trillion.
So there you have it. If an essay is flagged as plagiarism, it very likely is. And I think the takeaway here is high school seniors are under enormous pressure to get into college, and the internet is right there, filled with inspirational quotes and pithy wisdom to copy and paste.
But similarly, the internet is also right there for colleges and universities to use to battle, potentially, against the copy and paste. WBUR's Andrew Phelps on these newfangled methods of plagiarism. Thank you so much, Andrew.
Thank you, Meghna.